Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Chelly.
November 17, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this indeed is the show you were looking for. How do I know that? Because you're hearing me say what I'm saying. And as it is, you would have to search out this show to find it. So recently kicked off of YouTube, recently still kicked off of AM and FM. We don't have that deal in Los Angeles yet, but we're working on it. All of that has happened, but we're still alive and well on your radio apps, as you well know, if you're hearing us live. And if not, you're catching us further on down the stream via your Fondle Slab of choice, your applicable application. Welcome to the O'Chelly Effect. It is Thursday as I speak. But again, your experience may vary. In the first hour, I am very happy to have Mike Swanson with me, the man behind WallStreetWindow.com. Be in the know. Go to WallStreetWindow.com. It's not just about Wall Street. And he is the author of two pivotal books, although he's the author of many books, but two of them that I highly recommend are The War State. That's that red book you see on the sidebar at O'Chelly.com and many, many other places. Recommended and, in fact, required reading as far as I'm concerned. And not only that, but the first of a series of three books, Why the Vietnam War, Michael Swanson. And joining us as a special guest, somebody who has, if you've been listening to the network for years, you're familiar with him, but we have not seen him in a bit, Carmine Sabastano, who is the author of Two Princes and a King, also a guy who has done, how many series with us here on O'Chelly.com, the JFK Myth series, the JFK 101 series, the various different historical deep dives, sinister history of all sorts, kind of wondering why nobody's digging through the archives to go get the one that we called Putin on the Hits, because we talked about the very interesting track record of the guy running Russia, well, a few years before he was really the big headline grabber he is today. Anyway, all that, and in the second hour, we have the essential author once again, who actually occupies more spaces on my bookshelf than any other author, Larry Hancock, back with us once again, and it is so, so good to have Larry back. He's going to be back with us on a regular basis. And why are all three of these guys together on one show tonight? They converge in an interesting place, and it is about the JFK Lancer Conference, which starts, ready, tomorrow. And you should go and sign up. I know on social media they didn't say that I'm participating yet, but I am. I've already recorded something with Robert Grodin. I've already agreed to record a couple other things, including with my friend Carmine tomorrow night. We may not be able to do the live call-in show because of that, but no worries. A lot of stuff going on. And over the weekend, there may also be a live call-in event, a panel, which Mike Swanson and myself will participate in. I don't know if Carmine signed on for it yet, but guess we're about to find out. Now that I've run my mouth for, let's see, how many minutes? Well, looks like three? Yeah, I guess almost 4 minutes. Enough out of me. First off, Mike Swanson, how you doing tonight, man?
Oh, I'm doing good. It's great to join both of you. Well, with the panel Sunday, who is it, just me and you? Have they scheduled other people for it?
Oh, no, there's a bunch of us supposed to join. Other presenters, the details I am not entirely clear on, because some people might have said maybe, some people said definitely, and I'm not in charge, so I don't know exactly. I just know I'm supposed to show up, and others will be with us. So I know that for sure, but yeah, how's it been, Mike? You weren't with us last week, were you?
Oh, I'm doing okay. Just trying to figure out some stuff to do with my website, like usual, that I've been talking about in the past shows.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, next week I want to go for a little bit of a deep dive on some of that local stuff that's going on there, because you found a way to get under the skin of a couple of people in your area. So I want to get more into that, but this week we're going to talk, you know, more about the JFK stuff, I guess, and the conference, which starts tomorrow, which you're not doing a main presentation on, but thank you for coming along with me on this panel discussion, because God only knows what's going to happen during that. And it'll be good to have a friend along with me. Thank you. And you never know, man. And we're already talking about the possibility of getting together next year for the in-person event. I know that I want to go, and looks to me like some of my friends are going to join me. So we'll talk about that more on the Friday night call-in show next week. We'll be talking about it for the next year, I guess. Hey, why not get together? It'll be 10 years of the Ocelli Effect, plus the 60th anniversary of the JFK assassination. Why not if we all get together in Dallas? Sounds good to me. Anyway, so Mike, I'm just going to move over to Carmine real quick. Carmine, been a while, my friend. We have spoken privately, but in public we have not gotten together. How you doing?
Good. It's good to be back, Chuck. Good to be back here with you and with Mike. It's been a long time, and you know, like we've talked about off air, I'm doing a little bit of, you know, research here and there, but I've, you know, it was a long year. A lot of things occurred, as you know. You know, we've talked about off air and on air with just nonsense with our websites and other things. So I think it's good. Like I said, not only is it good to be back, but it's good to be discussing the case again. It's been a while since I've looked at. I would talk to Mike about some of the newer file releases, and I still have a ton of stuff that, you know, eventually I've got to get around to as far as cryptonyms and pseudonyms and other files that I want to share with people. And I know I have some more articles. It's just a matter of getting everything together and then trying to get all the site stuff back. You know, you've dealt with that with your website as well too. Maybe even Mike has too, where you just lose content sometimes after, you know, a hard drive goes.
Mm. Well, I think no offense to you, Carmine, but I think Mike has been a little smarter about it than us as far as protecting his stuff.
So
he's had maybe a few less problems than us, but and you needed a little bit of a break. I mean, there was some controversy out there in public, and it came up on this show, and I'm not going to avoid it tonight, but I'm also not going to focus on it. You know, it was what it was. It is what it is. And as I stated then and now, you know, you're my friend, and, you know, and you're a good guy. And, I know that, you're actually back on track the way I see it. And I'm just going to leave that statement there if you don't mind, and, move on to what is, if that's cool with you.
Oh yeah, no, that's fine with me. Yeah. Like I've said, you know, things occurred that, you know, couldn't be, Things occurred that I believe, you know, were, and when I made errors, I later, you know, discussed them with you. I publicly, you know, retracted a few things. I made mistakes, and, you know, and now, as I've said, I've, you know, now I held myself to the standard that I've always held myself to, as far as if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. Mm. And I can be wrong, and everyone can be wrong.
There you go.
About certain things. Sometimes there's a dearth of evidence that, you know, you think leads to one supposition, and it can be wrong. Mm-hmm. So, you know. And then I don't think it affected any of the quality of my research. I just think I needed to get away from some of, you know, the people. As you know, sometimes it can become, you know, the interactions between researchers, the interactions between people, can just become a problem for all parties concerned.
Well, and things have gotten weird over the past couple of years. I mean, pandemic times and all. So, you know, it just is what it is, man.
The human time bomb thing was, you know, I mean, it's unfortunately the isolation, the lack of any real quality communication between a lot of people has created lots of problems that were probably unnecessary, but might have been unavoidable in some cases.
Yeah, well, avoidable and yet unavoidable, because unavoidable because we're not in control of most of the circumstances. But the truth is that, you know, if people had honestly stepped back and examined some of this stuff, there might have been a way to avoid a lot of, well, chaos that has ensued and the damage that has taken place. But anyway, let's move on. You're going to do a presentation at Lancer. Unlike Mike and myself, you're going to be a featured presenter. But Mike and I will do the panel thing. I don't know if you're joining that on Sunday as well, But
yeah, I'll be there for at least an hour. I promise I'll hang out with you guys for a while.
All right, cool. So I've got two people flanking me at this. All right, now I feel a lot better. But you never know.
If they ask, I'm wondering what they're going to ask as far as, you know, just firing questions.
I don't know. That's the magic of it all. So it'll be, you know, live and unscripted, right? And I like that. So what are you going to be, give us a hint about what you're presenting at Lancer and, you know, what people could look forward to if they go and sign up, and I'll provide a link for that in the show notes tonight if you want to go do that and see what's going on in JFK research on the 59th anniversary before we get to the 60th and go and meet in person again. I think it'll be interesting to see where we've come and how far we may have come or not over the past 59 years, and Lancer's a good place to start. So what are you bringing to the table?
Well, I'm going to present, I've updated some things and I found a few other pieces of evidence, but I'm going to do a comparison of what historically have been mysterious subjects that people have assigned the assassin's role to, mm-hmm. and then compare them to another figure. Long-term listeners of yours will probably be among the only people who know about John Henry Hill.
Right.
Who is what I think it was still one of the most viable candidates for a possible either assassin or someone who provided an assassin a weapon, because we can put him, you know, we did the show on him years ago, and basically I did a little bit more digging into him as far as I could go and found a couple more statements. But basically I'm going to show three different subjects, you know, using motive, means, and opportunity. One being, some of your longtime listeners, once again, they'll know, Jose Mankel, QJ Win 1, and David Zizichvili, We Rogue One.
Right.
Both in various books, you know, in presentations, even I think up until 2000, you know, late 2010s, there was that book where they were trying to assign QJ Win 1 the assassin's role for Kennedy.
Well, right, and there have been many would-be assassins, say, in the literature over the years, and then there are these other interesting persons of, interest that come up. And Hill is a guy whose name has not been really revealed by too many people, and even when it has been, you know, they don't bring a lot of evidence, but we did on this show. Talked about how, listen, you can put a gun in somebody's hands who is a bit interesting at exactly the right time.
Yeah, 5 blocks from Dealey Plaza, 17 minutes
previous, before the assassination. Just before the assassin, previous to that timeline that we all are so familiar with. So how is this not a suspect, right? I mean,
who carried a rifle to lunch from Cullum and Boren and was seen by witnesses in the commission.
There you go. And, well, you know, why pay attention to that when you already had your predetermined assassin in hand? Anyway, there's that.
You can't assign a motive to and had no way to know about the assassination until the 17th when it was printed in the paper, unless he was part of a conspiracy.
Right.
So he's got roughly 30 hours to do everything with no motive.
Exactly. And we've talked about the Oswald timeline on here as well. So, all right, that'll be interesting. You're going to provide some clarity and a little bit of a review on a subject that you brought up before. So this will be good. And I'm going to sit there with you during that presentation and provide a little Q&A afterwards and see if we can't voir-dire you about some of these things. And, yeah. You know, get at it. I have no idea what I'm going to ask you because I'm going to let your presentation dictate what questions I ask. So that's the way that's going to go, and hopefully it'll add to the presentation. You know, that's what I aim
I
to
think
do.
So.
So, Mike, do you have any thoughts on this, what Carmine's planning on presenting, or, you know, are you going to be watching, interested, et cetera?
Oh, I'll be watching it for sure. You know, I just, you know, he's going to have new information that, you know, I know a little bit about the story from what he's told us in the past, but this is going to be a little bit more to it. You know, I haven't done, frankly, any original research or much looking at the assassination in 12 months. And when those files came out, the last batch of files, I did look through most of them. That doesn't really say that much because there was about 1,000 of them, and I think a lot of them were things that actually had been released before. But one thing I might talk about, if it's appropriate to fit it in there when we have the discussion Sunday, is where over the past 2 or 3 years, it seems to me that the new spin or disinformation, I guess you could say, misdirection for the case, that people associated with the Central Intelligence Agency, I would say, are putting out is an argument that Oswald was in a plot involving Cubans in Mexico City, and that's what they were covering up. And I'd say people associated with the CIA because it was an ex-CIA director who wrote a book asserting this thesis within the past couple years. And now I was reading a political article yesterday morning with the title of something, you know, what's covered up in the CIA files, something to that effect, what's missing, something like that, by this guy, Philip Sheldon, who had written a pro-Warren Commission book around the time of the last 10-year anniversary. But in that book, it hinted of this scenario that Oswald was involved in a plot with Castro Cubans, pro-Castro Cubans and stuff. But here's the thing about it. That evidence that he puts in his book, and I haven't read the CIA director's book, but I think it's pretty much the same. It was actually debunked in the recent files. The FBI looked at the witnesses and debunked it a week after, within 10 days or so after the assassination, you know, in 1963. So they're citing this evidence that's, you know, debunked in the files that have been released to try to misdirect people. And, you know, I guess that's the final misdirection, that and just saying that the Warren Commission is correct.
Well, there's that, and there's the Russian plot too, right? Because you have former CIA people involved in these documentary series that have been put out over the past few years that try to posit that Oswald may have indeed been part of a Russian plot, right?
Yeah, you're correct. I made an error there. The CIA director, that's what he's asserting.
Yeah.
That was a KGB plot. And the Sheldon guy is claiming it was this Cuban plot.
Well, yeah, but there's some crossover nonsense between the two, right? So, you know, it kind of rolls together where former CIA people are trying to push the idea that, well, maybe he was involved indeed and was a Russian agent or a Soviet agent, more technically correct, at the time. And I find that really interesting, considering that they spent the past couple of years laying that groundwork, you know, during this time when, you know, the whole rebuilding the Russian Empire kind of concept out there, and Vladimir Putin and, you know, Russian interference with the elections and all of that is swirling at the same time. It, you know, interesting when coincidences come together, right? Where there's seemingly a push to bring it all back to that. And I mean, hey, somebody could ask Vladimir Putin if he has any access to, you know, some files even, right? You know, was the KGB directly involved with Lee Harvey Oswald? He might know, since he was a former intelligence agent. Well, former, that's funny, but an intelligence agent for the, first the USSR, but then Russia itself, and now, of course, the de facto dictator of the Russian Federation, right? I mean, he'd be a person of interest, wouldn't he? He might have access to information, you might think. I'm throwing it out that, Mike, you know, what are you going to do? When you see a coordinated effort, I mean, sometimes you have to recognize the pattern, right?
I mean, but it's changed from, you know, when I first got interested in the case, and I think it was about the same time you did. I'm not sure. Carmine did a little later than us, I believe.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we were really young. But right for me, it was a year or two before the Oliver Stone movie came out, which created a huge wave of interest. Books, you know, I'd go to the, when that movie came out, you could go to the bookstore and there'd be a new JFK book out there every single time you went.
That's right.
But at that time, Gerald Posner, you know, was the mainstream media darling, and he was just defending the Warren Commission.
Right.
And I guess we've just, everything has just gone beyond that, that just simply defending the Warren Commission isn't credible or doesn't work anymore. So they have to create these other possible, scenarios to explain why it's covered up.
Well, after G. Robert Blakey, initiated the, you know, the lighting of the fire for the mafia probably did it. You know, scenario in the late 70s, because immediately following the conclusion of the House Select Committee, which, you know, found that there may have been a possible conspiracy, he goes out and publishes a book immediately and starts that whole trend of, hey, the mob did it, right? And then we had Mafia Kingfish and all those things before Oliver Stone that was pushing that angle for quite a bit. Gerald Posner's book was supposed to come out and slam the door, close the case. Right? And
it's
say,
closed.
Look,
it's closed.
Hey, well, and a big problem with his book, I mean, I just
one of the big problems with his book. Yeah, go ahead.
One of the big problems with his book is that he claimed he interviewed the autopsy doctors and he put the wounds mm-hmm. that they found in a different spot than the HSCA did and the Warren Commission did to match up with some computer computer animation scenario that he liked, and then it turned out, and this was in a Harold Weisberg book that was arguing against the case closed book, but it turned out that he never interviewed the autopsy doctors.
Yeah, of course not.
He claimed he did, but he never actually did, and they said that. So it's just a real mess in itself.
The later, I think, what was it, the controversy with plagiarism and other stuff with some of the online articles that he faced.
Oh, but that's later, you know. Let's go back to the Dale Myers, you know, worked on, inspired animation that was supposed to bolster Posner's claims. But, of course, it seems as though, you know, did he do all of his work is another question with Posner. And I posit that it likely did not.
I think I learned something very valuable in hindsight from Dale Myers, Mr. Myers.
Okay.
And that is that looking at animations and pictures is pretty much useless.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. That alone without any documents.
Unfortunately, you know, it's like a sinkhole. And, you know, I have avoided it, still do, trying to get into arguments about these sort of things. I don't think they're really that important. Like, is the Zapruder film altered? And if it is, to what extent? And, cause that, you know, if you say it's altered, then there's arguments of how much. And some people I respect are 100% convinced it has been altered. It's funny, like a friend of mine that y'all both have met who lives in Virginia, Jacob Hornberger, wrote a book about the Zapruder film and doesn't even, you know, his entire, it's like 200 pages, but he doesn't even talk about that issue at all. You know, it's not even important to him, but I just want to throw one, you know, thought about the case that I may never get beyond. You know, who did it, you know, well, the, David Talbot book.
Brothers?
Devil's Chessboard.
Devil's Chessboard. Mm-hmm.
In that, you know, he posits that Alan Dulles did it, but but in the towards the very end of the book, and it's where he gets the title from, he found that Alan Dulles gave a oral history interview, I think it was to the Kennedy Library, but it's in the final pages of his book there.
Right.
And I went, you can, after his book came out a while ago now, but I read the trans, you know, the oral history thing that he sourced it on too. But he quotes Alan Dulles as saying something to the effect that the assassination was like, happened as if sort of like a chessboard of different pieces on it.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody saw those pieces on the chessboard and was able to move them, basically, that's what he implied,
right,
to make the assassination happen. And now Talbot interprets that as like Dulles saying he did that.
Yeah.
But I didn't, you know, read it that way at all. I read it as a completely accurate rendering of what happened.
Right. No, I absolutely concur with you that Dulles's assessment is just that, an assessment. It's not an admission. It's an assessment, and it's an accurate one.
I just wanted to add quickly. Yeah. I think that no, you're both correct, and I think that one of the big, well, beyond, you can check out, they're on my YouTube channel and Mike's YouTube channel. But we talked about Alan Dulles' life, and Alan Dulles is not the spy master extraordinaire that everyone believes he is. He was actually more of a playboy in his time, as far as the two Dulles brothers. His older brother was the real power. John Foster Dulles was the real power of the Dulles family.
Mm.
And even though he was the director of the CIA, he still was more of a face man and, you know, a glad hander than an operational guy. He left that to a lot of other people. He just was a manager.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean he doesn't understand.
I don't think he had the... I'm not saying he did. I don't think he did it. I think you guys are right in the rendering of what he said. And he probably was just referring to it as, you know, and that's been used a million times in, you know, spy novels and various clandestine operations, that it is like a chessboard, that you're moving people around like pieces, you know, in your various theaters that you're operating in.
Well, to me, that's the key to understanding how it may have happened, how it whoever did it, how they did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think then the question becomes, who had the knowledge of the chessboard, so to speak, to be able to know everything about Oswald and to make what happened in Dulles happen.
Right.
And a lot of stuff happened in Dulles.
Right.
And I think, you know, I would like to look into the angle that Walt Brown presented in his last book,
mm-hmm,
and see, you know, look into that. I mean, that, he's basically posits that to him, you know, he's someone that was saying LBJ did it or used to, mm-hmm, and then came to the conclusion that he was wrong on that,
right,
for the period of time he did think that. And then he came to the conclusion that if you look at what happened at Dulles, look at the motorcade,
right,
and there was a lot of funny things surrounding Army intelligence people,
right,
in the Dulles Police Department, the captain that sealed off the Texas School Book Depository,
mm-hmm,
building and took it over was one of the heads of the Army Intelligence Reserves in reserve units in Dulles. He mentions that, a couple other things, but
one of the, I just wanted to, you know, respond that, one of the things about, John Henry Hill, one of the suspects that I'm going to offer, the viable one, I believe, anyway, in my presentation, is that he was actually friends with the owner of Cullum and Boren, the sporting goods store that he went and bought the rifle on the day of the assassination.
Right. Oh, wow. About him.
But they, and Cullum and Boren's owner and some other locals were the ones who helped make the parade route. Mm-hmm. So it would go past some of their businesses.
Yeah.
So they could have known weeks and weeks in advance about, you know, what would the possibilities were before, you know, while Oswald has his 3 days.
Exactly. And the thing is, I tend to agree again, with some of what Walt posits in that last book of his too.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold. Silver. The stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. Perhaps you're invested deeply. Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never before published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Support Chuck O'Chili at chili.com.
There's no money in it, so
yeah, that is
the problem.
That's the biggest problem, I think. And you know, some people would say that look, you're in an age when you can be independently supported, but quite frankly, I'm on that business model too. And look, I'm not going to complain, but I'm going to complain, okay? Because people want to support you, they love you to death, but honestly,
so if you're listening in, this is a very unsubtle request to support the damn show, and I want you to do this too, because you know, the Ocelli Report is one of the few places where Greg Palast can get his stuff out. I mean, you'll still see my bylines in some of these outlets, but nevertheless, I used to be a regular on CNN and on MSDNC, but no more.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com. Chili.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Second segment of the Ocelli Effect here on a Thursday night. Michael Swanson is with me, the guy behind WallStreetWindow.com. Be in the know, go to WallStreetWindow.com. But also, author Carmine Savastano joining us for the first time in a long time. So here we go. And we are talking about the JFK assassination. Interesting deep dive, actually, that I didn't quite expect, but let's do it, because this is where the interesting information is. And we're talking about, well, let's see, the hypothesis, right? Again, the various hypotheses. I'm not sure. You know what? My grammar not always the best, but what the hell. I'll run my mouth anyway. Hypotheses. Okay, great. Thank you. Carmine, always happy to be the grammar police if we need him. Anyways, so Mike, you were talking about, you know, partially Walt Brown's more recent thoughts about this, and where that does lead us in the right direction, I think. And some other things like the Dulles supposition that some people take as an admission. I don't go for that either because I don't think Dulles is the player. But there's still a lot of work to be done here.
Well, what Alan Dulles had is a metaphor that it's a chessboard, and someone moved around the pieces on the chessboard. Mm-hmm. And Walt Brown's book, he argued that there's probably a military element on that chessboard. Now, mm-hmm. The conclusion that I've come to is I think both those ideas are true.
Right.
But I've also come to the conclusion that to try to figure out who moved around these pieces, I don't think you can figure it out. I think they succeeded in carrying out their assassination, you know, almost 59 years ago. They got away with it. And as researchers and readers or just people just with any interest of it, no matter if it's a small interest or a big interest,
right.
In this case, you tend to want to know who did it. And you think of people that you hear about. Was it Alan Dulles? Was it Colonel Ed Lansdale? Was it, General Curtis LeMay? None of them, I think, did it.
Right.
I just throw those three names out there, and it's most likely, I believe, someone we've never even heard about that came up with the mastermind, so to speak, the plot and did the work of carrying it out. You know, it's probably someone that if we even knew their name, we wouldn't even know who they were, just some obscure middle manager type person.
Well, that's why I'm also looking forward to Larry Hancock's presentation because he may indeed have some other new ideas about this, him and David Boylan, who are working together, and I'm going to find out about that in the next hour. But I think it's still possible to unravel the chess player. You know, again, I think we've spent way too much time on the pieces on the board, unfortunately. But we had to know the lay of the land. I mean, you got to know how the pieces move, and you got to know what the pieces are. In order to know how the game is played. And I think that that has been successfully done, at least. Now,
well,
identifying the player is the problem. Yes.
Go ahead. I just wanted to quickly add, and I think that people need to keep in mind, too, that this mystery isn't just one that the public has suffered, but based upon, you know, the significant amount of evidence I've seen, I've discussed this with Mike and Chuck and other researchers before, I would venture to say that it is feasible that our government does not know the answer either.
Mm.
And that's something that a lot of people aren't comfortable with on this, who support the government's position. But I think that all the facts point to that because if they had a rock solid case, they would have built it. They would have put it to sleep. They would have won.
Mm.
And they haven't. Because they don't have the evidence to do it. In fact, the evidence that we do have that's available runs counter to most of the claims that the government has made about the case over the years.
Well, it's so funny.
Where now they're reduced to trying to come up with TV shows to hopefully distract people with bad ideas that were debunked decades ago.
Well, it's so funny because isn't that really the worst answer of all for everybody? Not just those who would advocate the government's official position, but how about those of us on the other side? This is actually a bad thing for most of them because, well,
yeah.
they don't have the answer.
I think the unknown middle managers that Mike was talking about are probably likely or, you know, like I talked about in my book, a conglomerate plot of just minor as far as the overall, you know, size and structure of the organizations they belong to, whether they be criminal or government. The minor players probably got away with it.
Yeah.
And they did it right under the noses of all these supposed great leaders like J. Edgar Hoover and Alan Dulles. But they did.
But imagine that. We're asking for files from the government and they don't have the answer either. We're asking for, tell us the truth. They don't have it. And, you know, so therefore it blows up the Warren Commission completely, but also it blows up a lot of what people have been fighting for, which is give us the answer. You have the answer. Give us the, and they don't have it either. That's a possibility. And that would be the most terrible thing of all is that, you know, indeed it is going to take somebody else with a unique piece of evidence, a unique set of pieces of evidence that are going to have to pull it together and finally, definitively, give the answer that actually nobody actually has. I mean, that would be the worst case for everybody. Yeah, Mike, you were going to say something?
There's another scenario that was actually, what's his name, Larry Sabato, in the 50th anniversary. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book that got a lot of mainstream media attention that year. He was pushed on all the networks. And he was saying contradictory things. Again, the simply propping up the lone assassin on the 50th anniversary wasn't really viable anymore. So Larry Sabato came out with a version that at that time I think was they were trying to push. And he would basically kind of say, we don't know. There's evidence that Oswald did it. The critics are bad, but it's also hard to believe that he did it by himself when you look at the evidence. So we don't know. And there's a possibility. And he put this buried in a footnote in his book. So if who's he think did it? You know, he buries it in a footnote. And his possibility was rogue CIA agents. Now, when I talk about my idea that we don't know who did it in this chessboard analogy, I'm not saying rogue CIA people. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that either. I think whoever did it, you know, they had to do a lot of stuff that it just couldn't be someone flying off the handle or a small group of people flying off the handle without getting the cooperation of others.
Yeah, but at the same time, the people that want to bring hundreds of people into this plot are also incorrect.
Oh, sure.
I mean,
oh, definitely.
You're still talking about a relatively small group of people.
Yeah.
I'm sure. And the other thing is, which is amazing here, is that Sabato's conclusion stinks of Posner's conclusion, which ultimately his closing statement always used to be in any presentation. The problem here with, you know, those critics and those other people that want to find a conspiracy is that they don't want to believe that a, you know, the loser Oswald could possibly strike down the great leader. That this kind of thing could happen. It makes the world too scary of a place for people like you and me, Mike, who are looking for a different answer because it would mean that, you know, there is no order in the chaos and therefore the world is far more dangerous person, a far more dangerous place, excuse me, if the person of the president is not even safe from the loser like Oswald. That used to be Posner's main conclusion to all of his arguments, and that has been the conclusion. You know, these critics or these conspiracy theorists or these conspiracy nuts or what did Von Pine used to call all of us, conspiracy kooks.
Yeah,
they all want to believe that it's something larger because it has to be something larger that takes down the president. Otherwise, the world is far more a treacherous a place than what it is we want to believe. So, and I see it the opposite way, really. I think that if you want the easy answer.
We're too young for that argument. It doesn't make sense to me.
No, it doesn't.
I don't think it's a good argument, but I think it would just apply to people who are like 5 years old in 1963. I mean, we were, you know, it doesn't make sense to apply that to
Right. If you were a child.
People our age or younger, you know, it just makes no sense.
If you were a child at that time, you know, maybe that makes sense. Right. But if you're not, if you're, you know, Generation X, Generation Y, Generation whatever they want to call themselves, after that, no, this is not the answer. It's not, this is the safe answer that we need a conspiracy. That's not true. It is more logical to conclude that not a lone individual did this.
And frankly, after, yeah, you know, after that 1993 period when this book came out, most conspiracies have been promulgated by government officials since then. I mean, you go on from, you know, the weapons of mass destruction, and, you know, now it's part of our entire culture. You look the past couple of years, with, you know, Trump having his ideas, then his opponents having theirs about him being involved with Putin when he was president.
Well, you know, and let me just throw out a general question to the listening public or to anybody, really. You know, explain to me this. What of significance has ever been accomplished by a lone individual in truth, right? What has really been accomplished, whether it be for ill or for, you know, for the betterment of mankind even? What of significance that is a pivotal thing, a pivotal event, a pivotal invention, a pivotal movement in politics, a pivotal, tell me anything that's actually been done by a lone individual, really. And you're going to have a hard time finding it, where one person all by themselves pulled off something. Well, it's very difficult. It's very, very difficult to find that. Go ahead, Karma.
I was just going to add, in this case especially, because it's such a short span of time, with such an inadequate weapon, with no motive, that the psychiatric specialist that the commission used could find.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they just picked a horrible guy to be their suspect. Right. If you really look into Oswald and you look into the commission's own files, same with Jack Ruby. I mean, boy, there's another coincidence. So the assassin gets assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happens that, you know, they allow one of the Campisi brothers to meet with him privately the day he gets put into jail after killing Oswald.
Yeah.
Who we know is a direct mafia link. Not to say that the mafia is responsible like Blakey thinks, but there's certainly so many threads that are loose, and they knew they couldn't tie them all up, so they just had to pick their man and go with it. And I think, too, it's also a matter of just basic human fear. I think that some leaders, as Johnson, you know, and privately admitted to Hoover in some of the files,
mm-hmm.
that he was afraid he might be next, and they didn't know who these people were.
Yeah, see, that's another way to look at that, where you know, these people that want to pin it on Johnson, they go, well, he was acting, you know, he knew that there was no way in hell that this guy ever had an idea that when he's talking to Hoover on the phone or when he's making these notations or anything else, that anybody is ever going to hear about any of this. I think he was honestly asking, were any of those bullets for me? Am I, you know, in danger? He was asking this question because I legitimately think he thought he was. Because he didn't know.
And that conversation blows apart the,
the LBJ.
That conversation has, in itself is unanswered. You know, he says that Oswald was in, Hoover tells him that Oswald was in Mexico City.
Right.
And that the CIA taped him, and it doesn't match Oswald's voice. And here we are, almost 60 years, and we've never been able to hear those tapes.
No, of course not. But that's the thing. Hoover, who did hear those tapes, Hoover,
said it wasn't him.
Who was not an idiot, okay? I mean, you can say a lot of things about Hoover, but is he an idiot? I don't think so. Is he ill-informed at the time? I don't think so. Sat there and said, you know what, the CIA is BSing me, okay, wrote that,
yeah.
You know, wrote that down physically, too, that they were lying to him. He knew that, and he knew he was being, you know, misdirected himself.
And to this day, none of these CIA surrogates have ever explained that.
No.
Ever.
No.
Never. I want to hear this Sheldon guy explain it.
Yeah, exactly.
Explain it, Sheldon.
Really?
Or if you know, another thing is that I was, like Mike talked about the Politico article, I was looking at one of their excuses too is that they're trying to protect living sources still. So, I mean, these are people like Jacques Richardson, that one guy we did a show on that I dug up who's living overseas, who was working under UNESCO. I mean, they're in their 90s, their 80s and 90s. I mean, they're not at threat anymore about a small part of the Kennedy case that they're involved in. And if they can shed light on it, just let them.
Well, see, but as
I
said,
really going to hold them until.
And what are these people? What would they have been involved in anyway that would make someone want to get them?
Yeah, but see, as I said on Twitter,
the KGB's gone.
Yeah, but as I said on Twitter yesterday, okay, I said this yesterday because somebody put out this thing. What is the CIA still hiding with their files? And I said, you know what, man, you're asking the wrong question, because after all. Whether you know it or not, if you go to try and find all of the files on the Lincoln assassination at the National Archives, there are slips there. You know, I know it's crazy to think about going there in person and dealing with paper and all. You know, I mean, okay, Grandpa. But still, if you were to go there and do that, there's stuff withdrawn from the Lincoln assassination files. You understand? That you can't see. Yeah. So they always withhold... This is not a matter of they're holding something that, you know, they're protecting a living source. Even if you argue that somebody was 20 years old 60 years ago is still alive, they're 80, fine. Somebody was in their 30s is still alive because they're 90 years old now, fine. But you know what? Problem is that those sources, oh, we're still protecting sources, we're still protecting agents. No, you're not. You're not.
Yeah.
That's
not
what it is.
They're not active agents. There are no 80, 90-year-old agents running around on the streets doing spy work.
You know, I know Sugar Ray Leonard is out there playing pickleball or whatever, but trust me, these CIA guys are not actively still, you know, that's right, I was there in Guatemala in 59, and now I'm here. No. Okay, no. It's not, this is not what's happening, okay? So the idea that, you know, well, what are they hiding? What are they hiding? What do they always hide? And what are they going to continue to hide until forever? You know what I'm saying? All right.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And who even knows? I mean, that was when, just real quick, when we talked about when I did that presentation with David Biedo, and I got to actually talk to one of the analysts from the CIA, or former analyst from the CIA, and he affirmed to me that the clandestine side and the analysis side were always in opposition. So half of the CIA didn't even know what the other half was doing part
right.
of the time.
So
that's another thing that adds to the confusion of the entire era.
Oh, I know. And you and I went through this on this show, talking about how the CIA was put together, how, you know, people incorrectly assume that the OSS just logically turned into the CIA. That's not true.
We had to shift through a few more groups.
We had to shift through a few more groups. We talked about the pond, okay? We talked about...
the pond's a perfect example of some sort of minuscule organization that could get something like this done, and no one would ever know a thing about it.
Well, there you go. And just because they had been, defunded at the time doesn't mean that they still weren't breathing. You know, think about this for a second. If they're a clandestine... means of funding that are available to the CIA, cocaine, and things like that, right? You think that stuff just goes away the minute the government says, you know what, we're going to take this organization and we're not going to officially keep backing it. You think all that stuff just stops on a dime?
Yeah,
no.
And some of it doesn't get shifted perhaps somewhere else for other uses.
Yeah, some of it does, and some of it disappears, and guess what? Some of it actually remains secret, too. Don't forget. Okay, so, look, all I'm saying is that an organization like that, not even that one, but one like it, could have still been breathing at the time and could be the answer to this, that was no longer on the government books, per se, but still had all the connections, still had the funding. Still had the sources of income that are off the books. This is possible, but somebody's got to lay it out. I'm not saying that I know this. I'm saying that this is a logical possibility. That's all I'm saying. Okay? And to just, you know, CIA, 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 okay, great. But, you know, evidence.
There's over a dozen other organizations.
Right. That we know of. That we know of.
Multiplying.
And now, who knows?
Well, and that's the thing, is what other of these organizations didn't get swallowed up by another? You know, who's to say which part of the international policing units of something else didn't become part of the FBI's channels later? You know, why let a government office and good assets go to waste? We went through that too, just like when we went through the whole, you know, Operation Paperclip. Well, let's go past that. Let's go into the guy that they got for surveillance who was clearly psychotic according to everybody's analysis. And yet we're going to use him for surveillance. Because, well, he's paranoid. He might be good at it. I mean, literally.
Yeah, and that was repeatedly, we saw that. Just people who were, even some of the figures I'm discussing tomorrow were highly interesting. Both were highly questionable, too, as you, for use in sensitive operations. But they wanted to use them, so
exactly.
They would use whomever they wished.
Exactly. So, with all of that having been said, again, you know, this is an interesting topic. I urge people, go ahead and check out JFK Lancer this weekend. The videos will be available after also. But if you get involved in it directly, you'll be able to participate in that live roundtable on Sunday. I don't know which parts of this will be live, recorded, etc. I'm not organizing it, and I'm not involved in the committee there. But I will tell you, I think it's going to be interesting. Some of our friends will be there, including the two gentlemen I've been talking to for this past hour. Mike Swanson will be with us on Sunday there at the roundtable questioning. I don't know how that's going to go at all. But also, Carmine's going to join us there, and he's doing a presentation tomorrow night, which I don't think is going to go out live, but, you know, it will be recorded and played at the conference, along with some other interesting segments. I recorded one with Robert Groden. I know there's stuff with Larry Hancock who's coming up in the next hour. So, anyway, WallStreetWindow.com is Mike's website. TPOC, is that up and running, Carmine? I have not looked at it in a bit.
Yes, TPAAK.com, TPAAK.com, still going strong.
Still going strong. Carmine's website, TPAAK.com, stands for Two Princes and a King, which coincidentally is the book that Carmine authored. And Mike Swanson has authored many books, but the two that I highly recommend, The War State and, of course, Why the Vietnam War, which is the first in a series of three about that particular conflict. And we'll be looking forward in the future to new information about it. As well as Mike publishes it in the next couple of volumes. Anyway, thanks, Mike. Thanks, Carmine. And thanks to you guys for listening. Stick around in the next hour. Larry Hancock, the author of many books, and also presenting at the JFK Lancer conference starting tomorrow night. Stick around. The Ocelli Effect continues after this.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to Larry-Hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at Amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Do you like history, real history, that you were never taught in schools? Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia. By author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before. That'll open your eyes to events that led up to this. Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961. Get your copy today at Amazon.com. Why?
The Vietnam War by author Mike Swanson.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
The views expressed by callers, co-hosts, or anyone else who happens to get on the air at Ocelli.com do not necessarily reflect the views of Ocelli.com or Chuck Ocelli, and we are not responsible for any stupidity which might ensue. Thank you.
What would I do? Revelation through conversation. In a radio show / podcast. You want the good news? Listen to the Ocelli Effect. Chuck Ocelli is the most underrated voice in all media. News, education, and entertainment. The Daily Bread from Ocelli.com. Go there. Save yourself from ignorance. Ocelli.com. But we all agreed to put Ocelli.com on and listen to the Ocelli Effect. Revelation through conversation. Ocelli.com.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to Larry-Hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at Amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com.
Get ready for the Ocelli Effect.
Segment number three of the Ocelli Effect tonight, this Thursday, and we are live and loud, so glad to have you along. And Mike Swanson and Carmine Savastano with us in the first hour talking about the Lancer Conference and JFK, the assassination in general. Few interesting ideas. Mike Swanson even yelling at a guy, demanding that he gives an answer to his interesting article. So if you missed that first hour, you might want to rewind and check it out, because you don't get Mike yelling at somebody all that often. Pretty good there. But anyway, in this hour, really, really pleased to have Larry Hancock with us. And, of course, he is the author of a great many books. Where should I begin? Creating Chaos, Unidentified, Someone Would Have Talked. Wait a minute, that might have something to do with the Kennedy assassination. And a few other things, Surprise Attack, right? The Awful Grace of God, you know, many, many different interesting books about political assassinations and the behaviors of the national intelligence apparatus, not just in the United States, but maybe elsewhere. We may have to discuss creating chaos again very, very soon on this show, just because of the current headlines and such. But I'm not going to ask him about what he thinks regarding the missile landing in Poland and all that, because we're going to discuss Kennedy stuff today. Okay, but you never know. Next time I get Larry pinned down on this show again, we may go there. Larry, first off, how you doing tonight, sir?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good, Chuck. It's good to be back.
Listen, I'm so pleased to have you, and so pleased to hear that you're, you know, back at it all the way around. You know, you presenting at the, Lancer thing this year, that's interesting. I want you to know, though, that there may indeed be a little road trip, a bunch of, Ocelli.com people talking about making a road trip for the 60th anniversary to go in person to Lancer. Cause that'll be 10 years that I'm doing this straight, and, 60th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination altogether. And we might just, I don't know, get together as friends and have a good time in Dallas, for the 60th anniversary. So if you're there, Larry, you might encounter a bunch of us, in 2023. What do you think?
Shoot, a road trip sounds really good. Yeah, I've even mentioned to my wife that it's going to be kind of hard to avoid not being in Dallas for the 60th. I think that would be almost 30 years of Lancer conferences for me, at least 25 years. Mm-hmm. And I won't say that I miss Dallas every year, but there were a lot of interesting things at those conferences. The conferences were in-person conferences are always highly educational, whether it's in the room, the hallway, or the bar.
That's it. That's what I'm thinking. And we're going to definitely go for some education next year. But before we get there, this year, you and David, who has made an appearance on this show before, if you check back in the archives, David, now I'm always afraid to say his name because Boylan or Boylan, I'm not sure if I'm mispronouncing it.
You're asking somebody from Oklahoma to pronounce a name correctly?
Yes.
I say Boylan.
Okay.
It just looks like that to me. And he never says anything about it, but David's a nice guy, so he probably wouldn't.
Well, there you have it. But, forgetting about how we pronounce his name, what are you guys going to be presenting about? I mean, obviously I don't want you to give us the whole presentation here, but, what are you guys going to be, doing, talking about specifics, give us an idea about what people might be able to encounter starting tomorrow at the online conference this year from you guys.
Yeah, this really culminates, I would say, the better part of 2.5-3 years of new research that we have been doing, quite a lot of it building around David's excellent work in understanding what was going on with the CIA in Miami, but not just Miami. I think we're at the point now where David can actually, using documents, like sketch an organization chart for the special affairs staff under Fitzgerald, the station staff in both its operations and maritime operations at JM Wave. It's been a tremendous advance in understanding who was really doing what? Who was being copied on what memo? Mm-hmm. Who would have known about what? And just a lot of digging and legwork. And it was only after we got to that point with his research that I think we began to appreciate that JM Wave, which all of us have talked about for years, by 1963 wasn't just a single entity. You had maritime operations going on under Shackley and Morales and Moore, which were very largely independent. I mean, it's kind of fascinating to find that JM Wave on its own, with Fitzgerald's approval, who's being designated by JFK being in charge of the new special affairs staff and essentially the new Cuba project, JMWA was coming up with its new round of aggressive operations against Cuba, mm-hmm. while Robert Kennedy was chairing a new interagency Cuba project that was embarking on its own deniable project. And all of this was happening independently and kind of understanding who played what role, who was talking to whom, gave us a new view into 1963. Mm-hmm. And Chuck, you and I talked about it, the fact that, you know, you can't paint with a broad brush. What the CIA was doing in 1960 is different than 1961, is different than 1962, is different than 1963. If you start making overgeneralizations, you don't get it. And so, long answer to your question, David's research has given us a much better understanding of what was going on in around CIA Cuban operations in 1963, a lot of which was not the maritime operations that we've talked about for so long, right. You know, a lot of which turns out to be political action and counterintelligence directed at the Cubans, the mm-hmm. Cubans in Mexico City, the Cubans in New York, at the UN, and what we really will talk about and what we didn't expect that we would uncover, but which David did, was a direct connection between those activities and New Orleans and what was going on around Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans. And well, so that's what sorry, go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is, you know, in general, people bring up the Bay of Pigs here, right? And they say, okay, well, everything goes back to that operation and so on and so forth. And people have tied New Orleans to the Bay of Pigs operation. I mean, that's not difficult to do. But that is not the total answer here when it comes to what was happening regarding all of the Cuban operations. That doesn't give you a true sense of the spectrum, so to speak, of all of what was going on and all of the possible, you know, funding, different actions taking place, different players being introduced to one another. It doesn't give you the full lay of the land, does it? It's a little too limited if all you do is focus on the Bay of Pigs and what was tied to that operation, what assets were being used, who was meant to be funding it, heading it. Who was, you know, it goes well beyond the Bay of Pigs. I mean, how else do I put it, right?
Yeah, I think the best way to look at it is that some of the people stayed the same. I mean, the CIA officers stayed the same, even though a couple of them might have been transferred off to other projects. Right. Largely, the CIA officers that we see at Special Affairs Staff and at JMWave in Miami are the same guys who were part of the original Cuba project in 1960 that led to the Bay of Pigs in 1961. Mm-hmm. But just because the people are the same doesn't mean that what they're doing and their roles are the same at all.
There you go.
For example, one of the people that David will be talking about, Emilio Rodriguez, which, you know, we've talked about before, if you go back to 1960, 1961, Emilio Rodriguez was deep in a stay-behind network inside Cuba, mm-hmm. Assisting with assassination attempts, doing a lot of stuff on the ground. Then by 1963, and very extremely well. I mean, he did it well. He did it deniably. Extremely good performance. He was exfiltrated. By 1963, he is in JMWave at Miami and has a totally different role, working in political action and counterintelligence. So you can't take what they were doing in the Cuba Project and the Bay of Pigs and map it into 1963 because roles changed.
Mm-hmm.
Reporting changed. And that seems like a trivial thing, maybe, the organization chart, but it's not in terms of what their day jobs are, who they know, what their tasking is. So that's a large part of what David will be talking about, is what we've learned in regard to what Miami Station and the Special Affairs staff knew about Lee Harvey Oswald in 1963. Thanks to his work, thanks to Jeff Morley's work, we know that Lee Harvey Oswald was well known in Miami Station and the Special Affairs staff. He was actually known within Congress. He was actually, it's one of the things that fascinates me is that for so many years, a decade, maybe two decades, I always pondered, you know, like, how would Lee Oswald become known to the conspiracy? Well, now we find out that Lee Oswald was known to everybody and his brother, mm-hmm. you know, that might have been involved in the conspiracy. That mystery is resolved.
Well, that's an interesting problem for those that support the Warren Commission's conclusion, because the idea that the reason why he got away with it as the lone assassin, right, according to the reasoning that's generally put out by people that support that, is that nobody knew who this loser was. He was nobody, right? So that's how he got under the radar. Nobody knew. Nobody had an idea who he was. And if they did, they didn't take him seriously because he wasn't meant to be taken seriously. Or am I mischaracterizing this, Larry?
No, that's the Warren Commission and the CIA, with the CIA's help. I mean, not by shielding information. That the whole point was, Lee Harvey Oswald was asocial, antisocial, a lone nut, potentially violent, and had no connections to everybody. You know, like his wife knew him, and that's about it. You know, so yeah, you're painting it exactly correctly, which is a totally different picture than we now have of Lee Oswald. And actually, that's what I will be presenting about in my presentation at Lancer. Over this conference is essentially a new view of Lee Oswald.
Mm-hmm.
David's going to give a new view of what was going on around Lee Oswald in New Orleans, both in the intelligence community, his connections. When I say connections, I'm talking about people that knew about him, were monitoring him, were tracking him in Miami and in Washington, D.C. And he will also be talking about his new associations within the ultra-right in New Orleans. If you want to call it the Shaw, Ferry, Bannister ultra-right connection, although, as it turns out, his entree into that group was through some of the first people that he met in New Orleans when he made his first, it's interesting, his first inquiry into kind of re-entering the Cuban venue in New Orleans exposed him to a person who was the son of an extreme ultra-right figure directly connected to Guy Bannister and to the brother of this same individual who was Emilio Rodriguez doing counterintelligence and political action back in Miami. And it's like, what are the odds? Oswald stumbles into this language school and starts hanging out with people that will introduce him to the ultra-right and will monitor him quickly going on the radar in the CIA. You know, so David will be talking about that, but what that really led us to after we thought about it a lot and looked at Lee Oswald's behaviors in New Orleans, his behavior after he returned to the U.S., it really raised some questions with me about things I've written in the past, my own view of Oswald.
Well, first and foremost,
which was, yeah.
Well, first and foremost, you're talking about his behaviors in New Orleans. I mean, do we get a new lens, so to speak, on his, you know, his scuffle in the street with Berenguer and you know, which subsequently led to the radio and television interview. Do we get a new perspective on that? Because that's always been one of those points that everybody goes to and says, look, you know, here he is acting as a, well, for lack of a better term, a leftist, right? A leftist extremist who is in support of Castro and all that, you know, Fair Play for Cuba committee thing, which he faked being a part of that organization because it was actually an organization. But he claimed to be the treasurer, right, of the New Orleans chapter. And clearly this is something that looks like, well, an operation where you're attempting to deceive people into believing that you're on one particular side so you can suck in some legitimate people to your cause, to your circle, and perhaps you're just there to explore their organization as they welcome you into it and this kind of thing. I mean, do we get any new information or new insights into that behavior? Because you're laughing. Go ahead.
We definitely get a new lens to view it. And okay. This will be a very much a contrarian lens. Because David and I have both reached the conclusion that the Warren Commission gave an extremely distorted view of Lee Oswald as a lone nut, as we were just talking about. And I think my feeling certainly is that the JFK community has generated a series of what I think now are distorted views of Lee Oswald, which run the gamut. I mean, you know, Chuck, one of the things we face if you talk to five different people who are conspiracy believers in the JFK community, you will find everything, every view from the fact that Lee Oswald is an ultra-patriot that had been manipulated and controlled from the age of 8, 10, 12, whatever, before he was a teenager, and that everything he does is part of an intelligence operation. Every move he makes, he and a double, I mean, that's one view,
right?
All the way to people that I see post every day that are simply speculating on whether Lee Oswald was an active participant in the attack, duped into it, or a patsy in the attack, duped into it. But in all of those cases, and I will talk about in my presentation, all of those views on the conspiracy side essentially take the view that Lee Oswald was somebody's tool all the way through. So the Warren Commission has him as, you know, a lone individual who really is more or less psychotic and just wandering around until he goes terribly bad.
Wanting to make his mark in history, apparently, yeah.
Yeah. The conspiracy community has him viewed as a tool. Manipulated by, working for. It's just a degree of, is he actively taking orders and doing things? Is he somehow being manipulated at various stages and just, you know, watched or influenced?
Right.
But they see him following certain intelligence-oriented agendas.
Well,
the presentation that I'm going to make is counter to both of those.
So in other words, you're not going to wind up running the gamut. I've always said he runs the gamut from useful idiot to James Bond, depending on who you're talking to.
Yes.
You know, and that's the truth. I mean, I seriously, you talk to people who are informed, no less, not people that are just terribly ill-informed, although you can get this from ill-informed people as well, but people who know the case, who know the details, who have studied it, and you can still find these varying, like, Rorschach test type views on this, where I'm telling you, it's everything from he's this dumb kid that was used and manipulated by somebody, he was sort of informed, but not informed enough, and he thought he was doing one thing when he was actually doing another, you know what, he's actually master spy, that just, you know, somehow got turned in the wrong direction, but quite honestly, they just sucked him in and decided to use him as a fall guy, but really he was the guy who's gonna disrupt. He's there as a, well, what did they call that? The team that's there to put a stop to the assassination, you know?
Right. And, yeah. And it's the abort team.
Yeah, yes. The abort team. That's what the phrase I was looking for. Thank you. you know, he's part of the abort team, and in that case, he's James Bond, but he was betrayed, you know. And I go, well, how do we all look at the same evidence and come up with these really wildly different perceptions? And what you're saying is the view that you're going to present this year is not going to fall under any of that?
It will fall under the useful idiot view, okay, in terms. But what you have to do is get more of a sense. And you've covered the bases well there. If you think about how the CIA would think of a useful idiot, the CIA, I mean, there is such a thing as spying, but spying is where you put somebody in a place where they're more likely to either have direct access to, you know, your adversary's technical data. You know, spying is not James Bond was an operations guy. He received missions to do things, bad guys, to the enemy, right?
Mm-hmm.
He didn't spy so much, he did things. You know, he made left a cryptologist and got her her translation machine. You know, this is James Bond. He's in CIA ops, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He's not a spy per se. Spies are generally recruited because they are in place within your adversary's organization. They have a day job, you manage to subvert them, but they're in a position to get you information. They're inside already. You don't force the issue.
Okay.
Walk-ins are great if you can get away with it. But the useful idiot is really somebody who's doing things on their own. And you mentioned creating chaos. I discussed this in Creating Chaos. They're doing business on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And you manipulate them in a fashion so they end up helping your agenda. But they have their own agenda. And that makes them more useful because the best cover is a credible cover.
Well,
the,
like finding a guy who
is...
The
cover is somebody doing what they... Actually doing what they appear to be doing.
Well, like they'll find a guy who's organically putting out the type of propaganda that they want out there. And what they'll do is just, you know, redirect some funds and make sure that somebody magically shows up and helps them do that. Hey, listen,
exactly.
you like putting out these leaflets and they think it's a good, useful leaflet. How about, listen, I'm just a local businessman. I happen to be interested too, and I'm going to give you the money to print a million of these. You know, hey, I'm just in support of you. Now, what you don't know is that somebody, you know, in an agency gave that guy that money to do it. And this guy thinks it's a legitimate situation, and therefore he's useful because, well, he's doing what you want him to do, and all you're going to do is help. And, you know,
like I said, that's the best cover is when he's doing what he wants to do.
Right.
You know, that nobody can penetrate that cover because it's real, you know?
Yeah, no matter how you beat and torture that guy, all he's going to tell you is, no, this businessman came along and said he supported my cause, and this is my cause. And you can't crack a lie on that because he's not lying. I mean, that's just the way it is,
so
right?
If you want to put somebody into Russia,
mm-hmm.
the best thing to do would be to find someone who wants to go to Russia and help them go to Russia.
Yeah, somebody
they
who's already going there.
You know, so my view is going to be a lot. My view, literally, and I didn't jump at this. I asked myself this same question. It's like we've all put Oswald in a box. They're just different boxes.
Mm-hmm.
What if Oswald really was Oswald? What if he had his own agenda? What if he was self-driven?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's useful at various stages. He's observable. He's exposed to the intelligence community. They know about him. They may manipulate him. But so what I decided to take a look at is, you know, could I find evidence for Oswald's own personal agenda?
Mm-hmm.
And what I found is that over the years, I had been kind of trapped into creating Oswald in my own mind from the assassination books I've been reading.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to step back a pace and take a look at some source material that doesn't get much discussed. One is a book about Oswald by a fellow who became very friendly with him when he was inside Russia, Titovits, Ernst Titovits.
Which is a great book, by the way. Book. Yeah.
Should be read by everybody.
Russian Episode is the title, if I remember right, and it's one of the only books that I've ever actually done a full-length review for. Sorry, Larry, I've never done a full-length review for one of your books, but honestly, when I read that book, it gave me insights that I could get nowhere else. And was incredibly good, and I was really happy to talk to Dr. Titovits. Have you interviewed him, by the way?
I have not personally. No, I haven't.
Okay. I would suggest that if you can arrange it, you do. Because, very interesting insights there that quite honestly, a lot of people have not heard from anybody. And this is a guy who knew him, was there interacting with him, and quite frankly, has a slew of tapes that the world has never heard of Lee Harvey Oswald. So, just saying, interesting, great piece of source. Yeah,
I'd like to do that. I'd like to get his take on what I've come to see as Oswald's own personal agenda. But so that's another source that I took a look at was Jack Swikes, who did not know Oswald personally, but was a counterintelligence officer at Itsugi. And was very familiar with the, and just showed up like a year or so after Oswald had left, very familiar with what was going on in the clubs that Oswald visited, the people that Oswald talked to, did a huge amount of research with Marines who had known Oswald, and quite frankly, Marines whose testimony didn't make it into the Warren Commission. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, okay, here's a view of Oswald in Russia. Here's a view of Oswald and how the Japanese experience affected him. Mm-hmm. Then I decided, well, let's look at the question of continuity. You know, if Oswald has a personal agenda, you know, that may have evolved over time. So let's go back and look at people he talked to when he was a teenager. And contrary to the Warren Commission, he did have friends. He did have hobbies. He talked with girls. He may not have had a girlfriend per se, but he had telephone conversations with girls. I think it's fascinating to read the Warren Commission and get this picture of this totally asocial loner, and then open up one of Grodin's photo books and see all these classroom photos of Oswald cutting up in class, Oswald talking to girls at the water fountain. You know, Oswald was a teenager.
Oh, and
you
just
know,
in his short time,
made him into something else.
Yeah, and just in his short time in Russia, a lot of people don't know that Oswald, you know, Marina was not the first Russian girl he asked to marry him,
and definitely not the only Russian girl he dated or had affairs with.
Right. So, you know, he to claim that he was this antisocial—that's always been weird to me. That people say, well, he was antisocial and. Now, I do understand from people that knew him that he was kind of cheap when it came to spending money, but he was very social. He definitely interacted with women, and men, you know, in interesting ways that would say to me, this is not an antisocial character. Titovits, his relationship with Titovits was interesting. Titovits being motivated by the fact that he was studying English. And he had, you know, unique access to a native-born speaker of the language, right? And therefore, there's the motive for Titovits' friendship with him. But what is Oswald's motive for sticking around and hanging around and with Titovits, right? Who was a medical student at the time. This is an interesting dynamic that reveals we're not dealing with an antisocial personality, in my view.
Definitely not. And so, okay, so there was that end. So we've got the middle of the spectrum. Okay, if we talk, we look about what he was doing as a teenager, what people had to say about him then. We look at what library books he was reading. And we know, we have a list of what, you know, what was he reading, what was he interested in, what were his hobbies. We know all that.
Yeah, he did check out a couple of books. He did check out a couple of books, if I remember correctly, that had something to do with John F. Kennedy as well, didn't he?
That was in 1963.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I'm just, you know.
So, but he did. He did have, Oswald was heads above any teenager that I can think of in terms of his political interest, his geopolitical interest, his, you know, and I come out of the same era that he did a few years later, but I mean, his interests were extremely broad ranging. He was handicapped by a couple of,
well, I believe he may have had
problems with his writing, and you know, so
he may have been what they would call today learning disabled on some level. You know, and that I think we can observe from some of the writing that he did, where you can see certain things that do give you an indication. I'm not saying I have a complete analysis of this, but that do give you an indication. And yet, when he's hanging out with Titovitz, he's reading Shakespeare with him and things like this, which are, you know, which is interesting because he's 20 years old, so he's a little bit past high school age, right? But he was 19 and 20 when he was in the Soviet Union, right? So,
and they're going to operas, for Lord's sake.
And they're going to operas.
This is a
yeah.
kid from New Orleans going to operas in Russia.
Right.
And we think he's, what, like, antisocial?
Right.
This is...
No, not only not just antisocial, but, you know, intellectually, a kid in 1960, you know, is this what they're usually doing? Not necessarily. This suggests a certain a grouping of interests, though, doesn't it? And,
of course. And we know what his political interests were as a teenager. He actually wrote to and tried to form a chapter of the Young Socialist.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Based on his readings, his conversations with his friends, his conversations with his friends' families, which got him thrown out of more than one house, by the way,
mm-hmm.
because of his political views. We know what they were as a teenager. So right. one of the things I did was to fast forward and look at the continuity on that
right.
and take a look at the same questions in 1963. What was he reading? What was he writing? I would challenge most JFK researchers to know or have read major monographs and position pieces that Oswald wrote during 1963
mm-hmm.
on a variety of topics. And quite frankly, if you read them, he was writing at a college undergraduate level and probably at sophomore, junior level of college, at least.
What year was it that he was writing the short stories, the fictional short stories?
He did some of that, attempted to do it in 1961.
Right, okay.
I'm sorry, in 1962, late fall when he came back, he really tried his hand at writing
okay.
something that he thought might sell, and it just wasn't, you know.
Wasn't that great?
Gorenshell took a look yeah. at it and said, Lee, you know, try again. Nobody's going to be interested in what you just wrote.
right. No. Okay, so I do recall that it was, I just couldn't remember the year, if it was 63 or if it was 62. I know it was after he came back from Russia that he had written some short stories. They're not particularly good or whatever, but they're also not particularly bad. They're not terrible writing. It's just that it's not something that's necessarily going to catch anybody's, catch on fire. It's not like, wow, this is a great story or anything. But, I mean, coherent,
The stories were not, but some of his writing on his things that he wrote, about the USSR
mm-hmm.
and the Communist Party in the USSR are well written.
Mm-hmm.
The speech that he wrote to give at the seminary, and we have all this. All of these they're all found in the Warren Commission appendices in the 26 volumes. You can go read them. and see what you think of Oswald in 1963. And half of them are typed because in 1963 he took a typing course. Mm-hmm. So we're supposed to think that this asocial, you know, Warren Commission figure is actually taking a typing course and writing on geopolitics, including a pretty pithy article in how you could merge American capitalism and Russian socialism into a new form of government. This is what Lee Oswald is doing in 1963, among other things.
Right, right. And somebody's bringing up in the chat room that Titovitz said that he was interested in Oswald's southern accent. And, you know, one might argue that Oswald didn't have a very deep drawl or anything. No, he didn't. But, again, to a Russian ear, it might come across a little bit different than it does to us, right? There are people that claim that I have a lot of a little Russian, I mean, not Russian, excuse me, a southern twinges in my speech nowadays. And then there are other people who claim that, you know, look, you can definitely, and I agree with them, that you can still hear the Jersey accent all the time. But it doesn't necessarily mean that that's the way it presented to Titovitz's ear. Just saying. And that's his speech pattern. This is different than his writing. And I dare say his writing was very different than his speech. It had a different character, so to speak. I don't know how to explain that. Am I way off here, Larry, or does that ring true?
No,
with you?
I think Oswald could express himself, and he worked harder at expressing himself in writing because he thought of it as more of a permanent record. You know, this is my position, this is my view. And in his speech, I think he would tend to get, it depends on who he's talking to. One of the things that becomes very obvious and is very consistent is if Oswald was talking to someone who agreed with him, he was a totally different person than if he was talking about with someone who didn't agree with him. If you didn't agree with him, he became very aggressive, very challenging, emotional at points. He would make fun of you. If you agree with him, you know, it's great. You know, you can have this. So different people reported him as being different. Well, but it had to do with the situation.
Well, it actually explains, I think, in my mind, the way that Ruth Payne used to, you know, characterize him. Where, look, she was clearly not somebody who necessarily agreed with his position, so he took a different attitude with her when speaking to her. And I think that is significant when people are describing this guy. Or, you know, if you take a look at Wesley Buell Frazier's characterization of the way Oswald spoke to him and was and all that, Frazier's not challenging him. You know, Frazier's not that kind of guy. So he's not a challenging figure. Oswald speaks to him completely differently than he would somebody who's engaging in a political discussion or this kind of thing, which, you know, from all accounts, Frazier didn't do. So you've got a different way of handling these things and the way he's expressing himself verbally, too, right? So I'm just presenting go ahead.
Yeah, there's some great insight into that from De Morenschild. Now, De Morenschild may be questionable. People have turned him into a major conspiracy figure, although I kind of like it because he was honest enough to say that the fellow he knew that from, you know, some intelligence agency sent him to look up Oswald and find out what was going with him, on with him. And, you know, De Morenschild didn't tell us everything about that relationship. But his descriptions of his relationship with Oswald, I think, are very revealing. It, based on what you just said, for example, here's the situation. De Morenschild took Oswald to visit a friend of his who was a senior military officer. Now, De Morenschild tried to be friends with everybody because it was part of his business. Networking was critical to him.
Right.
So Oswald goes with him, and they visit the guy, and the guy obviously – does not agree with Oswald's politics. They get into a fight, and he kicks Oswald out of the house, right? Okay, it's George, you know, I don't want to see this guy anymore. He's an asshole, you know, just, yeah. Yet to George was a much more aggressive type. George actually liked Oswald because they agreed on certain things, and Oswald was much more liberal than De Mornschild's son, who also kicked Oswald out of the house when Oswald and Marina went to live with De Mornschild's son. So it's like you've got De Mornschild, who kind of likes this kid, who thinks he's an advanced thinker, and De Mornschild's friends and son who kick him out because they think he's, you know, just, you can't deal with the guy. We don't like his politics. Is he argumentative, et cetera? So, again, it's very situational.
Well, and there's another dynamic at play there because the Russians that that Oswald is introduced to in Dallas and all that, I mean, on one level, they're trying to help out Marina, you know, let's go get her teeth fixed and this kind of thing, you know, and they're interested in her, you know, and trying to help her out. And meanwhile, Oswald is just this appendage to her. Now, I'm not saying that that's De Mornschild's position, but some of the people that maybe he was introducing the Oswalds to are taking that position as well. So there's a lot of things at play here where, again, if he's sort of the unwelcome guest and clearly people are oppositional to him, he's going to behave differently, and maybe rightfully so they tossed him out of their house. Maybe he was, because, I mean, look, the idea that he couldn't be obnoxious, which, again, being obnoxious in a social situation, I would not say is definitively antisocial in and of itself. Actually, to the contrary. What do you think of that?
Oh, I think that's a very good. That doesn't mean he wasn't social. That just means he had his own views.
Right.
I mean, and he wasn't hiding away and not expressing them. He was very open about them. And if he found some, he would actually look for people that he could relate to.
Mm-hmm.
But if someone didn't relate to him, yeah, you put it very well, Chuck. That doesn't mean you're antisocial. That just means people think you're argumentative. And De Mornschild, I think, gave a perfect description of him. He called Oswald as a proto-hippie. Hmm. Now, I got to tell you, having grown up in that era, I had friends who I could bring home, and my folks would kick them out of the house, you know, because there was – and I was – great getting along with them, and I didn't get kicked out of the house. But there, you know, that doesn't mean you're antisocial. It just means you disagree and you express yourself,
right?
Which is the opposite of being antisocial.
Well, and being a little too liberal in somebody's house, depending on where you are and when you are, could be perfect grounds for, you know what, get the hell out of here, you socialist. I mean, you know, yep. He's espousing. So, yeah, go ahead.
So the lens that I'll be talking about in the presentation I give at the conference is basically I looked for continuity. Mm-hmm. You know, what did Oswald, what was he saying, what was he doing when he was a teenager? And by the summer of 1963, you know, had that changed? And I'll be talking about how that had evolved. But what I found was a lot of continuity. And I guess what I found was, and Oswald, I reached a view of Oswald as an individual with his own agenda,
right.
And his own character, not anybody's, I mean, maybe useful, maybe steerable covertly, but not anybody who would take orders from anyone. I think that's very clear. He wouldn't take orders when he was a teenager. He wouldn't take orders when he was in the Marines. He wouldn't take orders when he was working at jobs. Even in Russia, one of the things you might recall from Titovits was just amazed, and I guess all Oswald's co-workers were amazed when he would speak up against the factory rules where he was working.
Right.
And he wasn't bashful. It's kind of like, this is stupid, or this is, you know, and everybody's going, we don't do that here. Well, that was Oswald. Oswald did not take orders. He did express himself, and you know, I don't think he was anybody's tool. I think he was a useful idiot. And well, that's the presentation I'm going to be making. Yeah. But if you don't give Oswald his own agenda and his own priorities and his own objectives, I don't think you can understand what was going on with him or around him in 1963.
Well, right. I mean, even if you take a look at his record during his time in the military, and the fact that he was, you know, disciplined for insubordination, more than once, right? You got a guy who, he had the firearm in his possession, at a certain point that he wasn't supposed to have. I mean, there's all kinds of things going on here where,
I interviewed several people who said, like, one of Oswald's things was that he would play games with officers. Mm. Officer, if Oswald gets given an assignment that he considered menial, and obviously that's going to happen a lot, mm-hmm. It turned him. He never liked anything he considered below his intelligence. So he would, and in front of the officers themselves, he would demonstrate that he knew more about politics, international relations, etc., than the Marine officers, and essentially attempt to embarrass them. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not a good career move, but it's just another example of Oswald being Oswald. Not antisocial, right. Just Oswald as a sometimes ass. You gotta be prepared for that. This is guy who's not gonna line up and march to your drummer readily.
Right. So, because we started a little late, we have a couple of extra minutes here, and I think this is going to be really interesting to get a new lens on Lee Harvey Oswald, but also to get a new perspective on the full range, the spectrum of what was really going on related to, what does everybody always go to? The anti-Castro Cubans, but, maybe more. Of that portrait that has never really been fully painted in. I mean, everybody likes to do the leapfrog from Bay of Pigs to this to that. But to actually fill in the gaps and give us an idea of the way the rest of the pond looked, so to speak, if we're going to leapfrog, is going to be helpful. And I think, obviously you're not giving us the whole presentation here today. But, I mean, I think it's going to be of interest. Are you doing it? Are you scheduled for Friday, Saturday, Sunday? Do you know?
I actually don't know. It's not Sunday. I think it's going to be on Friday. But, honestly, I'm not sure where it lies in the sequence at this point in time. But it mine and David will be – they're linked. Basically, David's in mine. He makes some comments during my presentation. I make a couple during his, so we kind of both did them jointly. Mine is basically a setup for his. Basically, it's kind of like, okay, if you take this view of Lee Oswald, then let's look at New Orleans. Don't take anybody else's view. Don't take the Warren Committee. You know, let's take this view and look at New Orleans. And one of the things that turns out rather amazingly from that is that an area that often has been ignored, I think, it's noted here and there that Oswald felt very strongly about socialism, mm-hmm. but he also felt equally strongly about racism, mm-hmm. which turns out to be, when you look at, if you read Jim Garrison's interview in Playboy, Garrison reached the conclusion that everything about Oswald that is related to socialism and communism was a put-on. Mm-hmm. Garrison portrayed him as an ultra-rightist, quasi-fascist, because that's what Garrison saw going on with Oswald in New Orleans.
Well, if you find that that's who you're associating with, yeah. If you find, and look, in fairness to Jim Garrison, right? If you find that this is who he's associating with, and you find that, the people that you can tie to him one way or another are clearly those type of people, you start to assume, well, if you're spending time with these kind of people, you must be one of these kind of people. So I don't blame him for necessarily coming up with that conclusion. But at the same time, it contradicts the fact that he did make writings even about his positions regarding race, about the social structure, if you will, of the world around him being unfair to particular groups at particular times and things like that, which are generally not the concerns of your extreme right winger. So, you know, I have a question kind of that I'm gleaning from some of the chat responses right now that I'm going to put together into one question for you about this new image of Oswald, which you're going to present. And then David's going to take that new image of Oswald and place it in context with these operations, which he is going to obviously run into, and the circumstances he's going to find himself in. But here's the big question from the chat. Do you think that this will clear up some of the contradiction and confusion that one might find if they are trying to examine this this character of Oswald, you know, through all these different writings that have been done over the years, different presentations? Do you think we're going to get some more clarity and finally get something that's a bit less of a contradictory view as we've been presented with, and maybe present that thing that you said many times, a bit more continuity in the view of the historical character, and therefore give us some clarity on the events?
It has for me. Of course, you know, that's just, I will say that the picture I have of Oswald now is not the picture I had 3 years ago. It's not the picture that I wrote about in my books. It's much more complex picture than that. But making it a more complex picture actually makes it simpler in a way, because if you try to capture Oswald as a real independent actor, mm-hmm, with a couple of agendas, from a geopolitical standpoint, and you add to the equation something that you probably read in Titovit's book or talked with him about, Chuck, and that is the fact that Oswald actually loved role playing, mm-hmm, and loved, I don't know if you, he loved inserting himself into roles and playing it, and that was a game he and Titovitz read, played, that they would actually, Titovitz would give him a piece of literature, and Oswald would kind of read it and relate to it, and then assume that character.
Mm-hmm.
What we see in New Orleans is some character acting that's going on. Oswald actually following two of his primary agendas in the whole world, which, because of his issues with Marina and his family issues, you know, he kind of reverted to some of the geopolitical interests that he'd had more passionately. I mean, enough so that he didn't care about holding a job, right? Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't interested in work that much. He was interested in other things, and he was subsisting on welfare, quite frankly. He threw himself into some new agendas, mm-hmm, and one was he had two boogeymen, if you will. He had two fights that he was waging, and one literally was against the ultra right, negatively, and the other was for popular socialism as he viewed it happening under Fidel Castro in Cuba. And I traced both of these in my presentation, but if you think Oswald is bright enough and able enough and capable enough to have these two agendas driving him, not somebody else driving him, his own self-fulfillment of these agendas, then you can see contradictions coming out of it. Because he's playing two games at the same time. But you can also see how badly that exposes him to people who can then manipulate him without it. He's exposing himself to two factions, as it were. Mm. And that's another, and to expose himself to two factions, he's got to play along to both, in both roles to a certain extent, and that breeds contradiction.
Well, you know, that character acting, I would love to hear a lot more of it, and apparently Titovitz has tons of tapes that would reveal precisely that if somebody were to take a listen to them, but they've never been heard, you know, by the world at large. And I think it would bolster and support your entire thesis that you just gave there regarding this. But as per usual, Larry Hancock always in the process of evolving the information. And I urge you to go to larry-hancock.com. Check out all of his books, any of his books, actually. And some of them on this subject, some of them on others. But, Larry, I'm looking forward to your presentation and looking forward to what I'll be able to learn from it. As per usual, check out Larry Hancock's blog. The links will be in the show description. And, Larry, thanks for doing this with me.
Oh, you bet. I enjoyed it.
And I'm going to look forward to his presentation at Lancer, but also to future presentations on this show. Larry Hancock, also thanks to Mike Swanson and Carmine Savastano for doing the first hour with me. The Ocelli Effect is done. No matter who you are, where you are, when you are, I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. Good night.